Phil Arrow, how did you get inspired to do environmental research and so forth?
Well, you know, Don, I've lived in Fresno almost all my life. I was born in Fresno and went through the public schools there, and really enjoyed my childhood and teenage years. And in the last 10 years, I've lived out of the country, first in Africa and then in Central America. And when I came back, I saw a city in Fresno, that is, and the surrounding area, considerably degraded from my memories of childhood. And I really wanted to see if I could contribute something to make this community and the various communities of the San Joaquin Valley all they can really be, and just work on our potential and try to do some of the things that make cities really exciting, wonderful places to live.
Was there a particular event in your life that triggered that? Was it just the travel and the shock of coming back?
Yes, it is a lot of that. As far as one particular event, I wouldn't say there's one. I do recall that when I was 12 years old, I had been in Phoenix, Arizona, and I flew back to Fresno. And as the plane descended to come into the Fresno airport, there was this kind of brown-gray material down there, and I just couldn't understand it. I had always looked up in the sky and been able to see the mountains and so forth, but it hadn't occurred to me that our air was so full of pollutants. And at that time, I didn't know what it was. I didn't know it was pollutants. But I was 12 years of age, and that was 1956. So in these intervening years, almost 50 years since then, it's gotten much worse, to the point that we have about 15% of all our school-aged children in Fresno, Clovis, and the surrounding communities who have respiratory problems because of our air quality.
What was the first thing that you decided to do to change things?
Well, I just had all these ideas bouncing around in my head for two or three years, and one of the people in the Central California Institute, the president at that time, suggested that I write up these things in a kind of a booklet form, which is what I've done. And I really enjoyed writing it up, and I enjoy getting feedback from people who read it and other people to whom I present in a kind of a slide presentation, a PowerPoint presentation. So it's something that somebody prompted me to do, and I've done it, and I'm just continuing to talk about all these various things we could be doing.
Can we talk a little bit about urban sprawl and displacement of agricultural land, since that seems to be one of the major problems in the Central Valley?
Sure. Urban sprawl has a number of, let's say, debilitating effects. One is that once the city is so large, the only way you can get around to get to the shopping that you want to do or to get to a school that you need to go to is by individual car. The distances are so great that perhaps you could use a bicycle, but on many days you can't when the weather doesn't permit and so forth. But for the most part, you just have to use a car. And for low-income people or people without a job and don't have any current income, it's very difficult to acquire a car. And then they're forced to use buses, and our buses generally are not very prompt as far as getting a person from the place where he lives to where he needs to work in a short period of time. Typically, bus riders who are going to work, it will take them an hour to 2 hours. And so this is a product of sprawl. For our farming, it means that there is more pressure all the time on agricultural land, and we have fewer and fewer acres to farm. We're losing in the Central Valley 10,000 acres per year at this point to urban sprawl. It's projected that in the next 20 years, that number of acres will get up to 38,000 acres per year that will be taken out of production. That will make the remaining farmland go up in price so that young farmers who want to enter farming will have this big hurdle to overcome, and that's that initial cost of acquiring the land. So this urban sprawl has all kinds of ramifications for us. The other, of course, is that when you have all these vehicles running around town, then we have more air pollution. And as you know, in the Fresno metropolitan area, 60% of the air pollution is from the vehicles running around town. So this sprawl really has a number of ramifications.
Do you have solutions to any aspects of these problems?
Well, one of the things I've talked about, Don, is the notion that we can somehow contain our cities. And what I've envisioned is putting a ring around our cities, which would be a leisure belt. And it would be a buffer between commercial farming and urban uses. The belt would be populated by smaller farms. In other words, instead of being 100-acre, 200-acre, or 300-acre farms, these would be smaller operations, 30 and 40 acres, maybe 20 acres. And these smaller farmers would be producing locally fresh produce so that they would be producing produce within just a few miles of where they sell it. As urban development is approved to be next to this belt, it could be adapted so that there would be little farmers market right in the plans as they are approved. So if you have a housing project, you could have two farmers markets that would occupy only half an acre. They'd be small ones. That would be maybe be 3 miles apart. And the farmers might sell at one on Wednesday mornings and at another one on Friday mornings, or some schedule that everybody can work out, the farmers and the residents. And they could also be part of new shopping centers where you'd have a little farmer's market. And these farmers, again, would not have to travel far. They could set up, sell, and be gone in a four-hour period. So they could be at one place on Mondays, another place on Tuesdays, and just kind of go to all these places around the perimeter of the city. And also in the industrial parks that they set up, the industrial parks could also have these little farmer markets. So the industrial, commercial, and residential sectors would all have little farmers markets. These farmers would sell locally fresh produce to people. And additionally, where the leisure idea comes in is that these farmers could dedicate 5 acres or 10 acres of their small farm to something like a butterfly farm, which would be where residents could come out, even city workers, if they get an afternoon off or something, people who work in the city, or just a two-hour break or something from a conference, people who are at a conference. They could go out to these little leisure parks, which are on farms. One would be a butterfly farm. Another one could be exotic fish or local fish, you know, have salmon and freshwater fish, keep the water cool. Another type of thing could be a petting farm that families would go to on weekends and holidays. And so these leisure activities would provide a stream of income to these small farmers. So they would sell not only produce, but they would provide leisure for city residents and workers and visitors. So this leisure belt would have a lot of amenities, both for the farmers and for these urban dwellers and workers who are near the perimeter of the city. So these people would have a vested interest in keeping that use as it is. And it would tend to make growth go inward so that when you have these vacant lots, those would be filled by high occupancy buildings, either high occupancy offices or a combination offices and maybe the first level commercial, high occupancy residence, so that you have places like the Silvercrest residence that we have in Fresno. It's about an 8-story building. You could have this kind of a building, and on the first floor you'd have your commercial. So you could have, for example, a family that sells spices on the first floor, maybe a East Indian family would sell spices on the first floor, and they might live on the second or third floor. And so they would not have to commute to work. They would be right there. So this high residential or high density residential, high density commercial concept would put a lot of people right in the downtown. When you have a lot of people working and living downtown, now you've got a lot of money to spend, and you can pay people who want to play music up and down the street. You could have street minstrels. You could have people who do mimes. You can have people do short skits and plays. You could just have all kinds of lively activity. And the streets themselves could be set up so that they have actually performing areas, little spaces that are provided that are, you know, set aside, planned for this kind of thing. And so by getting the city to grow inward, not so much inward, but upward, and filling these spaces that are now vacant with high occupancy buildings, we can really put a lot of life into the city, because we put all this money right at the cities in their core and their centers and out to this perimeter. So that's the kind of concept I have. What it would do, I think, for example, in the seven city area of Fresno, Sanger, Parlier, Reedley, Kingsburg, Selma, and Fowler, those are kind of projected to all grow together. And it's going to be kind of like a greater Phoenix, Arizona, where you just drive for 140 streets. I'd actually did that in Phoenix one time. I started on 70 East and I went to 70 West, 140 blocks, and there were stoplights all the way. And we can do that here too. But I think
they've done it in Santa Clara and Orange County.
We have all kinds of examples to see where we're going. And there's, I believe, an alternative to that, and that is to, in a very amicable, cheerful way, to put a ring around our cities that serves the people in the cities and these farmers around the perimeter, and gets our cities to grow upward. And as one city completely fills up its area, well, then we can have growth in one of these other cities and just spring up and around, instead of just the continual sprawl that we've been seeing.
Are there examples of farmers doing this kind of diverse interaction with city folks and city folks that are advocates for more creating more density in cities in order to have more efficient transportation systems and lay off the gobbling of the farmland?
Don, I don't know specific examples, but I do know there are butterfly farms. I do know that there are farms where they have little lakes, and I'm saying little. They'd be 300, maybe 500 feet in diameter, 4 feet deep, maybe 6 feet deep, place for the kids to play, and then there would be little shade roofs. There are those kinds of things now. Are they organized from the standpoint of having the local jurisdiction say, hey, let's do this and give incentives to farmers to buy this land? And in other words, the whole organization that would be required to make this happen, I don't know. I don't know if it's been done. I think that all the components are out there, and it would be a matter of us saying, yes, this is something we want to do in our region, and just doing it. So I think there are a lot of precedents that have been set in other places, things that have been attempted. We can learn from those things. And I think it's just a matter of deciding what kind of future we want to have and what kind of communities we want to have, and just making a commitment and doing it.
What's the next step, do you think, for accomplishing that around here?
Well, I've talked to two of the cities of those I mentioned, Parlier and Selma, and I'll be talking to others. of those seven I mentioned. I've also talked to some people at the planning in Fresno County. I think what we can do is basically keep pitching this idea that we don't have to have continuous urban spaces, that we can have large spaces between urban centers, not just green belts. Something that's been done in other areas is that farm land has been put into farmland trusts. There are nonprofit, non-government organizations that have access to large capital, and they can put out millions of dollars on a given project to buy up farmland. And basically what they do is they go to existing farmers, and they don't actually buy the land, but they buy what essentially is an agreement not to develop the land for other uses other than agriculture. So a farmer who is growing, say, for example, grapes now, if the grape markets became depressed, he could put in some other crop. He could put in almonds or peaches or something else. But he wouldn't, if he agrees to this and is paid for this, wouldn't be able to sell it to put houses in or a commercial center like a shopping center. And so these conservation easements are really a very effective tool to, one, keep the way of life for the farmer and other people who come after him who want to pursue this kind of a life. And on the other hand, give that farmer enough compensation so that he is well paid not to sell to a developer for residential or other urban uses. So
what I've noticed is that the parcels that are being taken out permanently preserved for farming are really not in any immediate jeopardy of being developed because of their distance from the urban fringes, and the non-permanent types of conservation under the Williamson Act is just temporary, and they cancel contracts, and so the farmer gets their tax relief before it's threatened, and then when it's threatened with development, they cash in on it.
Well, that's correct. The Williamson Act basically says that as long as you use the agricultural land for agricultural purposes, that you would pay a lower tax rate than someone next door to you who has never made the contract under the Williamson Act with the local county. That other individual, his land value will go up because it's potentially commercial. For example, it could be a shopping center or residential. So his land value goes up and his property taxes go up. But then he can sell his land and not pay a penalty. With the Williamson Act, the individual who agrees to that for a period of 10 years, that individual has to pay the back taxes as if the land had never been in that agreement. So they can be substantial. But, you know, when you're looking at land that's worth $7,000 to another farmer, and then someone comes into town, as in the case of Selma, where Walmart came into town and wanted to buy a vineyard, Walmart's able to pay $70,000 an acre for a vineyard, whereas a farmer could pay only seven. So it's an increase of tenfold. And when you get that kind of a enormous amount of money coming in, it's really easy to pay those back taxes. So what you said just a minute ago is exactly right. The Williamson Act was supposed to be a conservationist piece of legislation, but when you have these enormous amounts of money involved, it really doesn't have the conservation effect. It can just be too easily bought out, and that's what's happening.